Hello and welcome to Wizard Studies.
Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Audrey.
And I'm Katie.
And today we are going to be talking all about the house with the big reputation, Slytherin.
Yes, whether you love them or you hate them, Slytherins are quite the interesting house. Today we're going to be talking about some of the things that make them interesting. We're going to start out with the traits of Slytherins. So first I just have a couple quotes pulled from the Sorting Hat song. So they are, "Or perhaps in Slytherin you'll make your real friends. Those cunning folk use any means to achieve their ends." And then in another song he describes them as, "Power-hungry Slytherin love those of great ambition." So just from those, we can kind of get a sense of Slytherin House and what they value. So some of the traits of Slytherins that I found were ambitious, shrewd, cunning, strong leaders, achievement-oriented, and they also have a highly developed sense of self-preservation. So they're kind of selfish. You can kind of relate them to Gryffindors, which we talked about a little bit in our Gryffindor episode. They're quite similar, but I think what their motivations behind what they do are normally quite different. Gryffindors, like we said earlier, kind of normally act to help others, to be brave, to be the hero, to save other people, and Slytherins normally act to save themselves. So Salazar, when he was still at Hogwarts, he normally picked students that were clever, that were resourceful, were determined, and had a certain disregard for the rules, which is interesting. I don't know why you would pick students that break rules to go in your house. I feel like that would be counterproductive in winning the house cup.
I mean, Gryffindors also have a certain disregard for the rules.
Yes, that is true. At Harry and Fred and George.
And the Marauders.
And the Marauders, big time.
Pretty much every Gryffindor we know.
Pretty much. Even Hermione grows to break the rules.
Yeah, by like book two, she's like, all right.
So Slytherins tend to take charge and they possess strong leadership skills. They are very self-assured and they're very confident in their own abilities and competence. And they can also be similar to Hufflepuffs in that they are quite loyal. I think that we see that they stick together pretty well. I mean, I don't know if that's fully their choice or that nobody wants to hang out with them. Just kidding. But they can be very loyal, and they're very confident. And then, this was interesting, I found this online saying that Slytherins, you could make the argument that they are prone to deep, unrequited love. You can see this in Snape with his love for Lily. You can see this in the Bloody Baron and his love for Helena, which we'll talk a little bit about later. And we can even see this in Merope. I know that she didn't go to Hogwarts, but she is descended from Slytherin, and you could pretty much be sure that she would have been sorted into Slytherin if she did go to Hogwarts. And she was the mother of perhaps the most famous Slytherin ever, Lord Voldemort, so. And she had some deep love for Tom Riddle Sr. She ended up using a love potion on. I think that's very interesting that it's kind of a common theme with Slytherins that they have this such like deep burning love in them. And it's kind of sad that it's normally not reciprocated. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about blood purity, because whether we like it or not, that is a pretty big deciding factor on who gets into Slytherin. Blood purity was a really big factor that Salazar considered when he was still at Hogwarts picking students. And the Sorting Hat, you could make the argument, or you could even say that the Sorting Hat does take this into consideration as well. Slytherin is not a strictly pure-blood house. There are half-bloods in it. I mean, Snape, for one. And all pure-bloods don't automatically get into Slytherin, as we see with the Weasleys. But Muggleborns really don't get into Slytherin. I mean, we can see the Slytherin house, whether it's the people in the house or just kind of the house as this entity. They still have some prejudice against Muggleborns. You can see this at, I think, one of the passwords in the second book was something like pureblood.
Oh,
or
yeah.
So like, yeah, like you can still see it's a thing that's woven into the fabric that makes up Slytherin House. So I'm not saying that all Slytherins are bad and all Slytherins are prejudiced against Muggles, but it's a big part of the house as a whole.
For sure.
I don't think you can really separate the two.
Yep, definitely. All right, so then Slytherins' weaknesses. They're known for their negative views towards non-purebloods, as Katie was just talking about, and specifically Muggle-borns. They are pretty selfish and are usually acting and thinking in order to get themselves ahead. Like, we pinpointed the kind of difference we think between Gryffindors and Slytherins is that Slytherins are more for the self than Gryffindors. We know that they produce the most dark wizards and witches of any house. Not to say that we can't have dark wizards and witches from other houses, but it is a common theme. And their ambition often makes them power hungry. And then, just in general, because of all these things and because of how they're portrayed, they have a pretty bad reputation. I think it's only in more recent years, with sorting on Pottermore and everything, that people are starting to be like, yay, we love Slytherins, and embracing the good Slytherins, starting to celebrate the good things about Slytherin House and not focus solely on the racism, if we want to be blunt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Katie, what do you think about that?
Well, so in recent times, there's kind of been this, like you kind of said, like house pride for not only Slytherin, but for Hufflepuff, kind of the two that didn't have the best reputations post-book. I know that like Slytherin probably had a little bit worse reputation than Hufflepuff, but different, like a different reputation.
Right.
And then J.K. Rowling has kind of come out and said like, oh, like not all Slytherins are bad, like every house, blah, 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 is good in its own way. We can't like be stereotypical, but J.K., like, your books are what made the stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you did not give us a good Slytherin in the entire series. We only saw, like, terrible people in the Slytherin house. Like, you can't get mad at your readers for thinking thoughts that you put in our brains.
Right.
Like, if you wanted to break down those stereotypes, you should have written Cursed Child sooner. You should have written a better Slytherin. And I understand that the books are not the whole wizarding world. I know that she had kind of this whole other, the whole world planned out when she was writing, and she can't show every piece of it. Maybe that's why we like focus on Harry's story, and Harry didn't have a good view of the Slytherins. But I just think that she needs to take responsibility that she's the one who put the stereotypes in our minds. But
yeah, and I think it's interesting that I feel like it gets forgotten when the actual like traits of Slytherins get forgotten, and we more just think of them as dark because of this reputation. So like Hufflepuff, even though everyone's like, oh yeah, Duffers, whatever, the first thing I think of when I think Hufflepuff is still loyalty. But the first thing I think of when I think Slytherin is not necessarily like ambition or cunning. Because, I mean, I know that that's the traits of the house, but they're, like, when I think about Slytherin and Harry's day, okay, I think Draco, and I think he fits it really well, but then I think, like, Crabbe and Goyle are, like, the next Slytherins that we, like, talk about the most, at least, like, as students, and they're not cunning, they're just bad people, so that's how, that's, like, basically the only thing we get about them. And I don't know, maybe there's more about them that I'm missing, and maybe we need to break them down. But J.K., in showing us the two of the top three Slytherins, basically, that, like, Harry spends his time talking about, don't really fit the, like, cunning, sly, clever traits of the house. They just fit the, oh, their dads are Death Eaters.
Yeah, and I don't know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with the story that J.K. presented us with, but I think that she did have to save some face, like, when she came out with Pottermore and people were getting sorted in the Slytherin and people were upset about it, like, she had to patch patch it up a little bit. And I'm not, like, getting mad at her for it. I just think that, like, she had to have understood that she wrote the stereotypes the way that we see them, you know?
Right. If that makes yeah, sense. Exactly. Yeah, and it's hard for me to say, like, when I have friends say, oh, yeah, Slytherins are terrible. I'm like, well, no, they're not. They're just ambitious, but I don't have any... If you're not fully immersed in the Potter world, like, if you haven't read Cursed Child, and I don't know if you haven't... If you've only maybe read the books or seen the movies, I don't have any evidence for those people to say that Slytherin is not all bad. I mean, and we... Like, you can get into Snape at a different time. But basically, like, in the books, the students we see, at least, we don't have any evidence against it.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about Salazar Slytherin, the founder of Slytherin House. We do not have a birth date for him. We know that he was born in the medieval era, but we don't know any other information, which seems to be a common theme from a lot of characters. We don't have exact birthdays, which is kind of annoying. Why not just give it to us? But anyways, we don't know much about his wand, but we do know that it contained a fragment of basilisk horn, I assume as its core, which is pretty cool.
That's really cool.
Because not only is that not one of the three that Ollivander uses, but that's a pretty out there one.
I wonder if it's like an older thing. Like maybe it isn't might used be. Anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that. Ollivander's so picky with his wand cores. I wish that we knew more about, like, all of the things that could be wand cores rather than just the three that Ollivander has and the Vila hair that Fleur has. Salazar's skills are that he's an accomplished legilimens and one of the first recorded Parselmouths. So that's where we see that come down through the line to Lord Voldemort and then subsequently onto Harry. We learn in one of the Sorting Hat songs that he's from Fen. So Fen means a marsh or frequently flooded area. It's a flat, low-lying... They're flat, low-lying areas of eastern England, formerly marshland, but have been mostly drained for agriculture purposes since the 17th century. And the Fenlands, a.k.a. or the Fens, are a coastal plain in eastern England. If I could be wrong, but I think all, like, four of the founders are kind of from different areas of Great Britain. Like, I think Rowena's from, like, Wales or something.
I think was she Scotland?
She's Scotland. Maybe Helga. Yeah, maybe Helga's the one from Wales. But I think that's pretty cool that they're all kind of from different places. And then, so when he helped found Hogwarts, he was the one who only wanted to teach students from families whose magic was purest, so from pure-blooded families, and the other founders did not agree with him, and so that's when he chose to make his house kind of the pure-blood house, and that's where that comes from, where we talked about earlier how they kind of have this reputation of being prejudiced towards muggle-borns and mostly being pure-bloods, and then him and Godric were BFFs for a while until there was this huge falling out, and that's when Salazar decided to build the Chamber of Secrets and then eventually leave the school. But he didn't leave without hiding a basilisk in it, which is kind of like real petty there, bro. And we'll, like, the Chamber of Secrets becomes very important, as we know in the book, Chamber of Secrets. Big shocker. And then we learn a little bit more about his ancestry or his bloodline as it goes throughout history because Iseult Sayer, who is the founder of Ilvermorny, who we have that really long story about on Pottermore, is a descendant from Slytherin. And Slytherin's wand was buried in the school grounds at Ilvermorny. And then it eventually turned into a snakewood tree whose leaves have restorative powers. So I think we'll probably do a separate episode on Ilvermorny, if not Iseult Sayer herself. So we won't talk too much about that, but we do know kind of where his bloodline continues on through the Marvolos and through the Sayers, or I don't know if that's her maiden name or not, I can't remember. But Iseult and the founder of Ilvermorny.
Cool. Cool. Founding schools are in the blood. All right. So now onto one of Slytherin's most prized possessions, the locket. So obviously it plays a very important role throughout the Harry Potter books, specifically like 6 and 7. So we're just going to go into it a little bit. So the locket is described as a heavy golden locket that can be opened only by speaking Parseltongue. And I just wanted to read this description of the locket when Harry opens it. So kind of flashing forward a little bit, and then we'll go back and talk about the origins of the locket. But this is when Harry opens it in the Forest of Dean, I believe, right before Ron stabs it with the Sword of Gryffindor. So it says, "He looked at the serpentine S inlaid with glittering green stones. It was easy to visualize it as a minuscule snake, concentrating on the letter S, imagining a serpent, while the contents of the locket rattled like a trapped cockroach. It would have been easy to pity it, except that the cut around Harry's neck still burned. The golden doors of the locket swung wide with a little click. Behind both of the glass windows within blinked a living eye, dark and handsome as Tom Riddle's eyes had been before he turned them scarlet and slit pupiled." So I think that's probably the best description of the locket that we get. Of course, it's a description kind of the Horcrux within the locket, but I just thought it was really cool and a good visual of it. So this locket was first owned and created by Salazar Slytherin, and it was passed down through the Gaunt family, as we know. Marvolo and Morfin Gaunt, who were Voldemort's grandfather and uncle, got sent to Azkaban, and then Merope, his mom, pawned it to Borgin and Burks for 10 galleons, which was a total ripoff. But she was pregnant with Voldemort and desperate for money. They're pregnant with Tom Riddle, I guess. But she was desperate because the Tom Riddle, Voldemort's dad, had left her after she stopped giving him love potions. So she needed the money, and she sold the locket, even though her brother and father would have been very upset about this and would not have let her do it if they weren't in Azkaban. So the locket was subsequently bought from Borgin and Burks by Hepzibah Smith. And we see in the Pensieve with Dumbledore in Half-Blood Prince that Hepzibah showed the locket and Hufflepuff's cup to Tom Riddle while he was working for Borgin and Burks, and Riddle then, like 2 days later, goes back and kills her and takes both of these because he wants to make them into Horcruxes. He plants a false memory in Hokie, the house elf, so she confesses to killing Hepzibah, which then she ends up, I think the house elf ends up in Azkaban, and it's not until like the end of Hokie's life that Dumbledore is able to retrieve the real memory. So Riddle makes a Horcrux out of the locket by killing a Muggle tramp, which is really interesting because usually he used significant murders to make Horcruxes, and he didn't for this one, so it's kind of strange. You would think he would want a significant thing. He's all about all these like really powerful magical things and powerful people. So he just killed a Muggle tramp, and then he hides it, the Horcrux, in the seaside cave where he went on the field trip from his orphanage and hurt the two other kids. And this is the third Horcrux that Riddle, I don't know, is he Voldemort at this point? I guess he's Voldemort at this point.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the third Horcrux that baby Voldemort makes. Adolescent Voldemort.
What was the second Horcrux? So it was was it the ring? Was it the diary?
The diary, ring, the locket? Ring.
Oh, okay.
The locket. And then the cup, I guess. Because he got them at the same time.
Yeah.
So Regulus Black, Sirius's younger brother, finds out what Voldemort's done making Horcruxes. And he retrieves the locket from the cave, or goes to get the locket from the cave, and ends up dying in the cave. And he sends Creature back to 12 Grimmauld Place with the locket, and they leave a fake locket, which is the one that Harry and Dumbledore retrieve at the end of Half-Blood Prince, and that has the note in it saying, "I know what you've done, and I intend to destroy this." So Regulus had ordered Creature to destroy it, so Creature does everything he could to destroy it, but obviously he can't, because it's a Horcrux and it can't just be destroyed by anything. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione find out that Mundungus stole the real locket from 12 Grimmauld Place, and Umbridge then took it from Mundungus. So then they, Umbridge was using it to say that she was pureblood. She said it was a Selwyn family heirloom because it has that S, but she wasn't actually pureblood. And obviously, this locket is way more important than that. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione break into the ministry to retrieve it. And this is kind of like, I think of this as like kicking off the hunt for the Horcrux. It's the first thing that they actually do besides just like hiding out in Grimmauld Place for a while.
So yeah, that's what kicks off all the camping.
Kicks off the camping. But of course, once they retrieve the locket, they don't have anything to destroy it with. So they have to wear the locket around and they take shifts wearing it because it brings out the negative emotions of whoever is wearing it. And it's really cool because it makes the wearer unable to summon a Patronus, because Patronus, of course, requires like a very extremely happy memory.
So this is something I don't understand. Why did they have to wear it? I know that Harry says, I think in the book, like, we can't leave it, like, we can't just leave this in the tent. Like, it has to be in our sight at all times. But why not just, like, hang it up in the tent or put it in Hermione's bag? Like, I don't really understand why they have to wear it. And I don't know whether it's just kind of this, like, plot device that J.K. uses to, like, show the power of the Horcrux. But it really doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. I think it is just... I mean, I think in a way it's a plot device, but I also feel like it's just Harry being paranoid. I mean, he's already gone through hell twice to recover this locket. Like, one time it ended up being fake. So I think, like, to him, it's the most important thing they have. So he's not gonna... Like, even though they have so many important things hanging out in Hermione's bag, doesn't want to risk it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that they didn't have to wear it.
Right.
But who knows? Maybe they really had to.
Just to finish up on the locket, in the Forest of Dean in the winter, after Harry opens it using Parseltongue, Ron destroys the locket with the Sword of Gryffindor. And with that, another piece of Voldemort's soul. Dun dun.
I think this is particularly interesting, and it's not something I've ever thought of before, but the Sword of Gryffindor is what destroys Slytherin's locket. So I think that, like, rivalry between those two houses is, like, so embedded, not only in the characters and the fabric of those houses itself, but, like, even in the history of those houses.
Right, and in the objects, too, because, I mean, on our Gryffindor episode, you talked all about the sword. That was Godric's most prized possession, and then it ends up defeating one of Slytherin's possessions.
Yeah, I also think that it's really interesting that the sword is not only the only artifact from the Four Founders that survives, but it's the artifact that it at least destroys the locket, but it has the power. Like, it is imbued with the thing that can destroy all of them. I don't think it really does, because I think they start using the fangs from what they found in the Chamber of Secrets. Do. But, like, not only is it the one that survives, but it's also the one that could have destroyed all of them.
Right.
So, no wonder why Gryffindor is the most powerful house and the favorite house in everybody's eyes, JK.
Well, isn't it her house, too? Hasn't she said?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So, a little house bias there. I mean, we are recording this on Gryffindor Pride Day.
It is Gryffindor Pride Day, yeah. Yesterday was Slytherin, so tomorrow's a Ravenclaw.
Ooh.
So I'm gonna talk a little bit about the Bloody Baron, who we learned quite a bit about in the 7th book. But from his Pottermore profile, his skills are controlling peeves. And he does this because he is so intimidating looking. He's covered in silver blood, and he walks around with his chains moaning all day. The Bloody Baron is the only one that Peeves is afraid of, and the only one he listens to besides Dumbledore. His hobby is groaning and clanking up the Astronomy Tower, which is seems like a really sad hobby. I mean, I guess if you think about it, being a ghost, especially a sad ghost, is kind of the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because there's so many things that you can't do.
You can't
And you're just kind of, like, living... Yeah, you're just living this, like, half-life, and you've seen everybody around you that you, like, meet and talk to as a ghost who's human, like, die.
Yeah.
So, and then being... Let alone being a sad one that doesn't want to talk to anybody. Okay. So his death was he killed himself in remorse after he stabbed Helena Ravenclaw, and he wears his chains as an act of penitence. Sorry. Because he feels so remorseful that he killed Helena. So then I went in and found some more in-depth information on him, and this is from the wiki. So he was born into nobility, and he was born no earlier than 982, because we know that he was at school at the same time as the founders, and he was actually educated in Slytherin by Salazar. He was one of the first students in, at Hogwarts because he was taught by the founders, so they're obviously still alive. And then this is presumably where he met Helena at Hogwarts, who was the daughter of Rowena Ravenclaw. That's really hard to say, I'm sorry. Rowena Ravenclaw, who was the founder of Ravenclaw. And he fell in love with her during their days at Hogwarts, and he professed his love to her, and she always rejected him. So, again, with that deep, unrequited love that Slytherins have. So then Helena, because she always felt overshadowed by her mother, stole her diadem, which was rumored to give the wearer wisdom. And Helena ran away to Albania to hide from her mother and kind of everybody, and she just wanted to get away. And then this, after Helena ran away, Rowena actually fell ill, and it's legend says that she fell ill of a broken heart because her daughter ran away from her, which is really sad. I think that maybe Helena is a little bit of a petulant teenager. Just stealing something from her mom and, like, running away to the other side of the country because her mom's smarter than she is. I mean, I'm sure that there are other things going on, and we don't know the whole story, but I think that Helena, she's not my favorite. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
So when Rowena falls ill, she sends the Bloody Baron, which I could not find his real name anywhere.
He was always known as the Bloody Baron.
He just always has been the Bloody Baron. Yeah. So, I mean, we don't know his real name, so I'm just going to keep referring to him as the Bloody Baron. So she sends him after Helena because she knows that he would never give up until he finds her, because that's how in love with her he is. But I think the subtext of this is Rowena wants him to find Helena before Rowena dies. I think she wants to see Helena one more time before she dies, and obviously this doesn't happen, because even though the Bloody Baron was successful and he did find her in the forests of Albania, she would not follow him back to England. She refused, and this sent the Baron into a rage where he stabbed her and killed her. And then after his fit of rage passed, he was so sad and so mad about what he had done that he killed himself with the same weapon that he had used to kill Helena.
Heartwarming.
Yeah. Just all around really happy story. And then while at Hogwarts, post-death of both of them, they both decided to come back and haunt Hogwarts, which I think is a very interesting decision for Helena especially. I mean, I don't think she seems to not have the best relationship with her mother, who is a founder of this school, so yeah. I don't know why she would want to go back and spend eternity there, but
maybe to punish herself. She feels regret.
Maybe she does, and I mean, that's why the Bloody Baron probably didn't choose to move on to stay a ghost, because he was so remorseful for what he had done. But while at Hogwarts, nobody actually knows about this whole story. No living soul knows. And even dead ones. I don't think that nearly Headless Nick even knows this story. So the Bloody Baron is kind of a, I mean, all of the house ghosts are constant figures, but throughout the first six books, he's just kind of this, like, gimmicky ghost that's always just moping and moaning and dragging his chains along the floor. Like, you never really see him interact with anybody. We hear about how he can control Peeves, but that's just about it. And then we learn that he has this really heartbreaking backstory.
Yeah. So, Slytherin's common room. This is one of the common rooms that we actually get to see in the books. So I guess the only one we don't get to see is Hufflepuff. Rip.
Yep.
Sorry about that, Katie.
Yep, it's fine.
So it is described as a long stone room under the Great Lake with green lighting and elaborate carvings and located in the dungeons. So that's pretty cool. It's like under the Great Lake. It's accessed through a secret entryway in a stretch of bare, damp stone wall that requires a password. So it does require a password, but it's not, like, marked or manned by a portrait like Gryffindor's is. But it is the only house besides Gryffindor to use a password as protection. So just constantly these two houses, like, keep coming up together, which I think is interesting. And then, as you mentioned earlier, Katie, when Harry and Ron enter with Malfoy in the Chamber of Secrets, the password is pure blood, which is during the whole debacle when the Chamber of Secrets has been opened. So I think it's a little bit insensitive, and I would like to know who decides those passwords. I think I couldn't find who decides the passwords. It changes every 2 weeks, and it's like posted on the board in the common room when it gets changed, but I couldn't find out who decides it. So
is
I wonder if it's like, Snape have something to do with that? Like,
probably. Is that how the passwords work for the Gryffindor common room? Because I feel like since the fat lady is the one who runs them, I think we talked, like, it's mentioned in a couple of series that sometimes she'll change it, like, super often.
Right,
sometimes
yeah.
It'll be one for a really long time. And then does she just tell the first person that comes in, like, after she decides to change it, like, oh, this is the password, and then it's, like, their job to spread it around? Or does it have the thing in the common room, like, Slytherin?
I would assume that she tells the prefix.
Mm,
and then it's like okay, starting tomorrow, password is whatever. Not pure blood, because I don't think Fat Lady would do that, but
don't think so either.
All right, so then there's a description in Chamber of Secrets when Harry and Ron enter that I just wanted to read. So it says, the Slytherin common room was a long, low, underground room with rough stone walls and ceiling, from which round, greenish lamps were hanging on chains. A fire was crackling under an elaborately carved mantelpiece ahead of them, and several Slytherins were silhouetted around it in carved chairs. And then I think I found on Wiki that it has low-backed black and dark green button-tuffed leather sofas, skulls, and dark wood cupboards all around. So it's kind of a grim place. I mean, I'm not a Slytherin, so maybe this doesn't appeal to me, but I would not. It doesn't sound very cozy. I mean, there is a fireplace, but I don't know. It's decorated with tapestries that have the adventures of famous medieval Slytherins, which I'm sure you'll get into some of those shortly, Katie, when we talk about famous Slytherins. But then what I thought was cool is that according to the Wiki, there's a portrait of Horace Slughorn was added to the common room in 2016 to honor his bravery in the Battle of Hogwarts. And the source on that was that ebook that JK has. It's something, it was like stories of heroism from Hogwarts or something like that.
Yeah,
that was cool. I never thought of that. I never knew that was a thing. And I also kind of always forget about Slughorn and his ties to Slytherin.
Yeah, later we're going to talk about our favorite Slytherins, and he was one that I considered for a while, because he's a good example of a Slytherin. He's not evil, but he's
morally questionable.
Him on a personal, yeah. I just don't really like him on a personal level. Like, he's very, I don't know. He's an interesting character, I'll just say that. So, speaking of some noteworthy Slytherins, I'm going to talk about a couple. And like I did for Gryffindor, I'm not going to really talk about ones that we meet in this series that much. I'm going to talk a little bit about Horace, speaking of him. But these are kind of ones that are throughout history or ones that we don't realize are Slytherins. I did not find any as interesting as Celestine and Warbeck this time, so we'll see if I can make it just as entertaining, though. So Merlin is actually a Slytherin, which is interesting because we talked, again, in the Gryffindor episode, we talked a little bit about how the Sword of Gryffindor could be related to Excalibur, kind of be that that's where J.K. got some of her inspiration. So with knowing that Merlin went to Hogwarts, we can see that those two stories are, in fact, connected. So Merlin is a member, or was a member, of King Arthur's court, and he actually was an advocate for Muggle rights, which seems very interesting with him being in Slytherin, especially kind of back in the old days, where maybe it wasn't as common for there to be people who fought for Muggle rights. And he's arguably one of the most famous wizards in history. So I don't know if this is J.K. just pandering to Slytherins by putting Merlin in their house. Because I really can't find the evidence to why he would be in Slytherin. I don't know the story of Merlin that well. But him being an advocate for Muggle rights just seems a little odd to me. But it's what J.K. says.
So. Hey, we'll take it.
Yeah. The next Slytherin that I found in my research was a woman called Elizabeth Burke. So at some point in time, there's no time frame, she was a headmistress at Hogwarts, and she had a portrait that was at the bottom of the grand staircase, which then got moved to near the entrance of the potions classroom, the dungeons, and she's been reported telling Slytherins to be nasty to Muggles, which is not a great look.
Kind of reminds me of the portrait of Sirius's mom.
Yeah. So next we have Miss Alita Lestrange.
Oh, yes. Also
red. We meet. Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Oh, spoiler alert.
I'm not convinced. Oh, yes. Spoiler alert. Miss Alita Lestrange, who we meet in Crimes of Grindelwald and like a little bit in Fantastic Beasts, but not really. She went to Hogwarts with Newt Scamander and his brother. And she loves both of them. That's about all I got.
Who does she love? We don't know.
She loves both of them, I think. I think she said it to both of them. But we will get into Crimes of Grindelwald at a later date. But Lita is a Slytherin, and she wasn't expelled. But she was caught up in the incident with, what creature was it? I can't remember. But some creature letting them loose on the Hogwarts grounds, and her and Newt tried to take the fall for her, but Dumbledore didn't believe him, but he's the one who got in trouble for it, and not Lita. But she's a Lestrange, we know that. She is, she has a half-brother that is dead, question mark?
Who knows?
We don't know. We don't know.
Who knows? This is a whole can of worms
So I'm just going to move on. But Lita's a Slytherin. Next, I have Phineas Nigellus Black, who was the headmaster of Hogwarts from some point in the late 19th century until 1925, and he is obviously a member of the House of Black. And he has a portrait in the headmaster's office, as all headmasters and headmistresses do, and he also has one in Grimmauld Place in the room that Harry stayed in during the summer in Order of the Phoenix. And then his portrait at Grimmauld Place, Hermione takes it off the wall when they go back in the seventh book and puts it in her bag, and they use him to communicate a little bit or find out what's happening at Hogwarts because of his other portrait being there, and Snape kind of uses him as a spy, and that's when he finds out that they're camping in the Forest of Dean, and that's when he can leave the sword for them So he becomes a little bit important in the seventh book. And then the last singular Slytherin I'm going to talk about is Professor Slughorn. So we kind of mentioned this earlier. He's kind of one of the first good, quote-unquote good examples of Slytherin we see in the books. He's not a Death Eater. He's not Lord Voldemort. He's not fighting on that side. So, I mean, that's about all we can ask for from Slytherin. And this is before we meet Regulus Black and before we meet any of the characters in Cursed Child. So he is kind of the first one that we meet. And he fights in the Battle of Hogwarts against the Death Eaters, and he doesn't seem to have a prejudice against Muggleborns, as evidenced in Lily Potter, or Lily Evans at the time, and Hermione, because he sees them as gifted students and doesn't look down on them by them being Muggleborn. He almost sees it as more of an accomplishment. He's like, oh, and they were Muggleborn. That, like, makes their accomplishment so much better. And whether that's right or wrong, it's not, I mean, it's better than a lot of Slytherin, so. And then Slytherin is kind of known for its dynasties that it has. It's pretty common for people of the same family to end up in the same house at Hogwarts, as we see with the Weasleys, but then it's not always a guarantee, as we see with Padma and Parvati, because they are twins, but in different houses, in the books.
Yes.
In the books is very key. So, the Black family, we have Phineas Nigellus Black, and then there's this whole list of Black family members. Calidora, Cassiopeia, Cedrella, Charis, Doria, Lucretia, Walburga, Alphard, Orion, Cygnus, Andromeda, Bellatrix, Narcissa, and Regulus. Notably, Sirius is not on that list because he gets sorted into Gryffindor and is a disgrace to his family. So, and then kind of another dynasty-ish that I saw was the Gaunt family, and you could pull in the Strange family and all kind of the Death Eater families, but the Gaunt family has Gormlaith and Corvinius, and then Tom Riddle because Marvolo and
Merope and
what's the other one's name?
Oh, I said it earlier.
I know.
I'm gonna
Why am I blanking Morphin. So much? Morphin. Ah, we thought about the same time.
I read it.
Morphin. they don't go to Hogwarts, but like I said earlier, it's safe to say that they probably would have been in Slytherin.
Yeah, and on the Black family thing, I just want to know more about Andromeda.
Yes.
Because that's Tonks's mom, right?
Yes.
Which, I mean, it makes sense that she's a Slytherin because she's a Black, but she also obviously does not follow the other Black family traits and beliefs. Yep. So
it is interesting that she would still be a Slytherin, though.
So maybe that's a good Slytherin.
Yeah, maybe. We don't really know much about her, but if she's Tonks's mom and she helped Harry,
yeah,
how much better can you get?
Alright, so moving on to talk a little bit about the Slytherin Quidditch team, which is the Quidditch team we know most besides Gryffindor. Basically everything in Slytherin is what we know most besides Gryffindor, but it's fine, I'm not salty. So the Slytherin team, they wear robes of green and silver, just like their house colors. And we know that they won the cup 7 times in a row before 1994, when Gryffindor wins. That's in Prisoner of Azkaban. So they're usually a pretty good team. Their strategy is brawn over skill.
As evidenced by Crabbe and Goyle making the team.
Right, which is just, I guess that speaks to their, like, ambition. Not Crabbe and Goyle, but the Slytherin team is that they'll do whatever it takes to win. But also, it's not very, like, it's not a cunning way to win, to just beat each other up. So, yeah, pretty infamously cheating and playing dirty tricks against their competitors, both on and off the pitch. There's that dirty foul we know a little bit about with McGonagall that was committed against her, and she ended up with broken ribs, I think. They always play dirty versus Gryffindor. There's the brawl with Harry and the twins, or one of the twins, and then the other one gets punished for it after the Gryffindor match in Harry's fifth year. So, yeah, not the most sportsmanlike team, but then this is just another way that we're contributing to the, or JK is contributing to the reputation of Slytherins. As far as we know, there's no girls on the team during Harry's time, but the Wikia has lists of players going back to, like, the 18th century. I didn't, like, I'm not going to list them here, but there are some girls listed. It pretty much just says, like, so-and-so was captain in the 1700s and whatever. But, yeah, so there are some girls listed. But that does, if we compare it in present day, or in the 90s, to Gryffindor, Gryffindor is pretty evenly girls and boys. So then they also have insulting cheers. Weasley is our king, which I think they do during, like, they're not on the pitch. They wear, yeah. In, was that in the Hufflepuff or Ravenclaw match?
I don't remember.
But, yeah, they play dirty even when they're on the sidelines. All right, so then some known players. We have, sorry if you can hear my dog barking. His name's Harry, and he's barking because he does not like the Slytherin Quidditch team.
He's Gryffindor.
He's go-go Gryffindor. Okay, so we have Miles Bletchley, who's a keeper. And in the 1995 season, he cursed Alicia Spinnett from behind in the library before the match versus Gryffindor. And Snape refused to punish him, even though there were 14 eyewitnesses. 14.
Snape is not a good guy. Snape is not a good guy. All right.
Cool your jets. We'll get there. but yeah, that's pretty dirty. Side note. A lot of the things I'm going to say about these players are not good, but that's just the information that's out there. I'm sorry to any Slytherin listeners. I appreciate you, and I love you for listening to our podcast, and I'm sure you would not curse someone from behind. So, all right, then we have Bull and Derek. We don't get their first names, as is the case, I feel like, with a lot of Slytherins, but they were beaters, and in the 1994 Cup Final, which is the one that Gryffindor won for the first time in 7 years. Bull hits Alicia Spinnett with his club and claimed that he thought she was a bludger. And I just wrote in parentheses after that, eye roll. Because this is a podcast, so you can't see me, but I'm rolling my eyes at that. That's a bad excuse.
Lord.
You know, Slytherins, I know they're not Ravenclaws, but they're supposed to be intelligent. Come up with a better excuse than that. So then we have Crabbe and Goyle, Vincent Crabbe and Gregory Goyle, and they were beaters starting in Harry's fifth year, and then I think they were also on the team in the sixth year, and then obviously seventh year was kind of a mess, but they were basically just there as Draco's henchmen, which is their role in everything. Marcus Flint is one that we know a little bit more about. He was chaser and captain of the Slytherin team in the first three books, so for 3 years at least. And he was known as a good flyer and player, but also kind of a brute. Lee Jordan has said that he flies like an eagle, which, I mean, that's a compliment coming from Lee Jordan, so
yeah.
It's nice. He does cheat a lot, though. He deliberately, like, flew into Harry during the Sorcerer's Stone match when Harry saw the Snitch, which you're not allowed to do. He crashed into Angelina in Prisoner of Azkaban after she scored. Just, like, he likes to crash into people, I guess. And then he scored 5 times when everyone was distracted by Harry's jinxed broom in Sorcerer's Stone. So Harry was, like, hanging there, probably gonna die, and he just went and scored 5 times. That's a little dirty.
Such a Slytherin thing to do.
The ambition.
Just kidding.
Okay, so then we have Draco Malfoy, and he obviously was a seeker, and he joined in his second year. Lucius basically buys his way onto the team with Nimbus 2001s for everyone. I mean, I feel like he probably would have made the team anyway, though, because we know that he's a pretty good player. It's just that Harry always shows him up.
Yeah, he probably would have been the best if Harry wasn't there.
Yeah. So
which
he
talks a little bit about on his episode about his rivalry with Harry.
Right. So he avoids playing a match in Prisoner of Azkaban when he is injured by Buckbeak. Injured in strong quotation marks there. Bold quotation marks. And then in Cursed Child, there's a conversation. I think he's talking to Harry when he says that, like, he never wanted to be, like, a ministry man or whatever. He did want to be a Quidditch player, which is kind of interesting. So, I don't know. Maybe in different times, Draco could have been a different person. Then I threw in Scorpius Malfoy here because in an alternate timeline of Cursed Child, he is a seeker. But in the real timeline, it's not very believable that he would be good at Quidditch, but he says he might try out because he wants to get Rose's attention. Which I just think is funny.
Because Rose is a Quidditch player.
Yeah, right? Rose is a badass Quidditch player. We love Rose Granger Weasley. And then the last person I have. Oh, no, there's many more. Not the last person. So then Montague is a chaser and also a captain, and he's on the team as early as Harry's third year, and he becomes captain in Harry's fifth year, and he's also part of the Inquisitorial squad, Umbridge's Inquisitorial squad, and the Weasley twins shove him into a broken vanishing cabinet, broken vanishing cabinet, and he manages to apparate out a few days later. Even though he hadn't passed his test, which is, that's really impressive.
It really is.
But, like, after this whole incident, he's, like, I think does he have to go to St. Mungo's or just the hospital wing?
He's very messed up.
But it's interesting because this is what gave Draco the idea of how to get the Death Eaters in Half-Blood Prince. Mm-hmm. So, I guess,
because I think,
shout out to Montague.
Yeah, I think Draco says something about, like, how he could hear sometimes what was going on in Borgin and Burks, like, when he was stuck in the in-between. But, yeah, that's, like, super impressive that he could do that. And, like, as much as I love the twins, that's, like, really bad.
Right. But
I don't know if they knew it was a vanishing cabinet, but they probably didn't know that he was going to be stuck in this in between. But I think that there's a scene where they're like, I could be wrong, I haven't read this book in a while, but they're kind of like laughing about how he's missing.
Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah, questionable.
Again, as much as I love the twins, that's a little,
sometimes they go a little too far. This may be one of those.
Yes.
Even if it wasn't intentional. No remorse.
Not really, no.
So then we have Warrington, who was a chaser, and he was 2 years older than Harry, and joined the team in Prisoner of Azkaban. He was attacked right before the Gryffindor match in the fifth book, and he was caused to look like he was coated in cornflakes. That's an interesting spell. I don't think we know who cast that curse, but the proof there that Gryffindor plays a little dirty too, you know.
Yep.
There's no rules when it comes to these two houses. And then he was also part of the Inquisitorial squad. And then the last person, for real this time, is Regulus Black. And we don't know much, but we know that he was a seeker in 1978 because I think Harry finds the photo of the Slytherin team in Regulus's room at 12 Grimmauld Place, and he sees, like, Regulus is standing. I guess they always stand in the same positions in the photo, and Regulus is standing where the Seeker stands, and he's like, oh, he was a Seeker, just like me.
So, we've been kind of bashing on Slytherin this entire episode.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but like Audrey mentioned earlier, we're just working with what JK gives us. But, so, I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of things that it might be in defense of Slytherin, some positives that they bring to the table. So I'm going to pull from a couple articles on Pottermore. The first one is entitled, Seven Reasons Why It's Great to Be a Slytherin. Some of these are kind of gimmicky. Like, I think one of them is, who doesn't look good in green? Okay.
This is JK's, like, trying to, she's like, it's okay, yeah. You got sorted into Slytherin.
Yeah, like, if you look good in the color, like, if that's your best defense, pretty weak, but there are some other ones. The one right above that is Slytherins are born winners, which we can kind of see with their ambition and their cunning. They use it to always get ahead. Another kind of gimmicky one is snakes are cool, which, like, I don't even know if I agree
snakes.
With. Yeah, they're kind of creepy to me. I'm not, like, terrified of them or anything, like some people are, but just not one of my favorites. It mentions that one of the greatest wizards ever is a Slytherin, who I talked about earlier, Merlin. And I didn't mention this when I was talking about him, but he is obviously what the Order of Merlin is named after, which is given out as an outstanding achievement. And it's funny because the last line in this section is, proof that Gregory Goyle may one day turn into a great inspiration. Okay, maybe not. I don't think I would hold out hope for that. One of the things it says in here is that the common room is quite picturesque.
which I drive to the common room.
Which, like, I think I would be more on Audrey's side. Like, it seems very dark and, like, cold and not very, like, warm and welcome. Kind of the opposite of the Gryffindor common room. But, hey, if that's what you like, no judgment.
One cool thing that I forgot to say about the common room, though, is, I guess when you get sorted into Slytherin on Pottermore, like, I know, like, when I got sorted into Ravenclaw, there's, like, more of a in-depth, you get, like, the prefect is, like, welcome you into the house.
Yeah.
I guess when you get sorted into Slytherin, it says, like, oh, we can even sometimes see the giant squid through the Great Lake, like, swimming by. That's pretty cool. I like that part.
Okay. I could not be in Slytherin because sometimes going to the aquarium gives me, like, really bad anxiety because the ocean and, like, creatures in it really freak me out.
Oh, I
like,
love
I really
the
like
aquarium.
Swimming in the ocean, but I really don't like thinking about what's under there. Like, I had to go to the aquarium for one of my classes, and I literally had, like, a full-blown panic attack.
Oh, my God.
So we had to do, like, assignments and, like, draw the fish we were seeing. I was like, I can't do this. I almost, like, called my TA in tears, like, telling them I couldn't do this.
That's funny.
So I could not be a Slytherin.
Well, I love the aquarium. I just went, like, last week, and I touched some rays. It was really cool.
No.
So
I can't.
Maybe there's
not
a little bit of Slytherin in me there.
Maybe. Yeah, I could not do the Slytherin common room. I'm not going to say it's, like, not cool that you're kind of, like, under the lake and you can, but yeah. There would be some very bad days for Katie if she was in that common room. Another thing that they point out is that not every Slytherin is a total git, which we kind of talked about. Andromeda, Regulus, Slughorn. They even mentioned Snape in this, which I don't agree with. Sorry, guys, but... so then another article that I'm going to talk a little bit about is entitled, Why You Should Fall in Love with a Slytherin. And I think that these have a little bit better points to make. They're ambitious, which is something that I think is pretty important to me, at least, when I'm looking for a partner. They have to have drive. They have to have goals. They can't be lazy. That's for me to do. They don't give up. That kind of goes along with their ambition.
Basically the same thing.
Yeah. They're cunning, which, like, I don't know if that's really a positive in a life partner, but...
Maybe if
whatever.
They're cutting on your side, but not against you.
Yeah, like, trying to achieve stuff that you want to achieve, I guess. But even, like, I would take issue with how we would do, how some things would get done if it was too cunning. They can be charming, which I think can be true. Like, Tom Riddle was so charming. He was handsome. He's got that charm. They can turn it on when they want to. They have a cool dungeon common room. What's more romantic than a dungeon softly lit with candles?
That's all it says. That's all it says for that reason. All of them have, like, a couple paragraphs, and then it only says that.
And then we all have a little bit of Slytherin in us, is what that says. Which
I
disagree with. I think I have a little bit of ambition. I like to think that Slytherin has. I don't know if I'm super cunning, but maybe that's something I need to work on. And then the last one is, why Hogwarts needs a Slytherin house. And the first one is because Slytherins can be brave too, which we kind of talked about in the Gryffindor episode when we compared those. Slytherin and Gryffindor are quite similar, and one of the ways that they are similar is with their bravery. Evidenced by Severus Snape.
And Slughorn in the Battle of Hogwarts.
And
Regulus Black, that's pretty damn brave.
Yeah, Regulus Black was really brave.
And you gotta admit, Snape was brave.
No, I mean, that's why I said him. He's brave. That doesn't make me like him anymore, though. Success is not to be sniffed at. So, I mean, Slytherins are successful in whatever field they choose to be in, for the most part.
Unless
you see that with Merlin.
Crap or Goyle.
Yeah.
I can't. Well,
I think
dies. Which one dies?
Crab.
Okay. I wonder if Goyle had any success.
Probably not. I think every house has a couple Crab and Goyles where they're just like, I don't know, they're just there. Slytherin teaches students that people are complex, which I think is something that, I don't know if taking it out of the context of the world of Harry Potter and putting it into the context of us reading the books, I think that whether we see it or not in the original series, we've come to terms with that, like, not all Slytherins are bad. We think about that with Snape, especially, and Draco, and a couple other ones. They're very complicated. You can't put them into boxes. They grow and change and evolve, and, you know, and I think that's something that Slytherin does teach us through the reading of the books, that not everybody is so black and white. There's some gray. Having cunning is actually very useful. I mean, I'm not gonna deny that. Having cunning can help you get ahead with things. And this one talks a little bit about Merlin and his position on Muggles. So Merlin, perhaps the most famous wizard of all time, was sorted into Slytherin House. His strong advocacy of Muggle rights clashed with the anti-Muggle position Slytherin House commonly takes. So the fame and success of Merlin is yet another feather in Slytherin's cap. So he obviously used his ambition and his cunning and his smarts to his benefit, and the benefit of Muggles, I assume, if he has was such an outspoken advocate. And then, not all Slytherins are corruptible, which I agree with. We can't say that all Slytherins are doomed to be evil from the jump. And then the last one is, without Salazar Slytherin, there would be no Hogwarts at all, which is, like, again, pretty weak, but
there would also be no Chamber of Secrets.
Yeah. There would also be no basilisk hiding in the school. And they say that Slytherin's drive and ambition and wisdom was part of the reason that, like, his contribution with his ambition and his drive and his wisdom is one of the reasons why Hogwarts came to be. And I'm not going to deny that, but also, like, again, kind of a weak defense.
Also, I think something we may have glazed over is that for a while, the school did function very well with all four of the founders there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't until a little later that Slytherin had his tantrum, yeah, and built the Chamber of Secrets and stuff. So, like, it was successful for a bit, so maybe it started out good.
Yeah.
All right, so now getting towards the end of this, we're going to talk about our personal favorite and least favorite Slytherins. So my favorite, I struggle with this a little because I was thinking just like the generic, like all of the Slytherins that we think of when we think Slytherin, and I couldn't think of anyone that I actually liked. But then I found a redeeming quality of Cursed Child, which, like, of note, neither of us have seen Cursed Child, so we drag it a
True.
Lot, but
I really want to see it, though.
Once you
I've
see
heard...
it, everybody seems to say that you love it. So, we've only read it, but I'm still going to continue dragging it, and then I will back up. Once I see it, I will back
yes.
up and say...
Yes, once we are famous podcasters, we can go see Cursed Child.
Right, if anyone wants to pay for me...
You can Venmo me.
If you feel very strongly about Cursed Child being great, then you should buy my tickets.
Yeah, prove it to us. We want our minds opened.
So anyway, my favorite Slytherin comes from Cursed Child. I like Scorpius Malfoy. I think he's a redeeming character, and a redeeming character for Slytherin. I think he's... I like how he's really nerdy. I think that's cute. He's just kind of like, I want to like protect him, you know? So I think he's definitely my favorite Slytherin.
So just backing up the points that we were making earlier in the episode, that J.K. Rowling did not give us any good Slytherins really until these spinoffs, when she's kind of had to backtrack and give Slytherin some good characters. I picked Miss Leta Lestrange, who we talked a little bit about earlier, from Crimes of Grindelwald. I think that she's very complicated. I think that her and Newt's relationship in school was super cute. I think that she's very, like I said, she's a very complicated character. She has a lot of things in her past and her history that has made her the way she is. And yeah, I mean, I love Newt and Theseus, so I get you, girl. I get the dilemma. They're both awesome. Wait, do we know what house Theseus was in at Hogwarts?
Oh, I don't know. Google it. I think, for some reason, I thought Gryffindor, but I feel like it wouldn't be Hufflepuff. Like, him and Newt are so different. Not because, like, you know, but because it's not, I feel like it's a sibling thing.
No, I agree too.
Do we know?
House Hufflepuff.
Oh, what? Oh my god.
Yeah.
Really?
I found this on the Wikia, I think.
Oh, that's on the Wikia. Okay.
Yeah, and let me see if I can find the... Yeah, during his formative years, he attended Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, having been sorted into Hufflepuff, where he excelled in his studies and proved himself as an academically gifted student.
Wow, that's really cool.
Let me, I'm trying to find the...
The source.
Citation, yeah. Number six. Six is... Snitch Seeker, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald cast on the final trailer in... Major spoilers. So it seems to be an article that was written. Or no, it's a video. It seems to be an interview. So maybe I'm not going to watch the interview right now, but I assume that maybe he said something in an interview.
Huh. Wow. I am surprised. Not because I don't think he is. I feel like he could have Hufflepuff characteristics. I don't know. Yeah. We don't know that much about him. But just because him and Newt are so, like, there's such a rift between them, I would have thought they'd be in different houses.
No, I agree. I'm surprised. I'm happily surprised, though. I got both the Scamander brothers. Again, I'm not... The source might be a little iffy, but that's what I'm working with right now. So.
Nice. Well, I think Leta is also a good choice for favorite Slytherin. I want to know more about her.
Me too.
But what I do know, I really, really like.
Yeah.
Also, Zoe Kravitz is awesome. So.
True that.
All right, so least favorite, I had trouble choosing, but I kept coming back to Lucius Malfoy, because I have so many issues with him. I mean, we talked about him on the Draco episode and his parenting and stuff, and I just think he's, like, the worst little rat besides Pettigrew. Yeah, I don't have much to say about that. Like, it took me a while to decide, but I think he doesn't have anything redeeming about him. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was pretty hard for me to choose just because there are so many bad Slytherins. I mean, like I said, like, we've been, like, bashing Slytherin all episode, but if you, like, sit back and look at all the Slytherin characters that are presented to us, and most of them are pretty bad. So I was deciding between Umbridge and Bellatrix, but I eventually chose Bellatrix just because I think she embodies Slytherin. When I think of Umbridge, I don't really think of Slytherin, but when I think of Bellatrix, I think of Slytherin. I'm sure that probably just has to do with, like, Bellatrix being a Death Eater and Umbridge not. But Bellatrix is just so cruel. Like, that... The scene where she's just kind of, like, mocking that she's the one who killed Sirius Black in front of Harry. Just, she just has, like, absolutely no compassion, like, no feelings. And I'm not saying that Umbridge does, but Bellatrix can be a little bit, like, just as sadistic as Umbridge, at least, if not more.
Right. I think, I don't know, Bellatrix didn't jump out to me as one of the... My least favorite. Umbridge certainly did, but I, again, like, I associate Lucius more with Slytherin than I would Umbridge. But Bellatrix didn't jump out to me because I think she's just such an interesting character. I mean, she's terrible.
Yeah.
I don't really like her, but I think I am intrigued by her character, so I think that's, like, I kind of forgive some of the bad stuff that she does.
Yeah.
And I think she's entertaining, honestly.
No, I agree. And that's semi why I didn't pick Snape, because, like, he's definitely one of my least favorite characters in the books, but also he does have some redeeming qualities.
Yeah.
I'm not going to deny that, but, yes. So, our pop quiz question today is, if you could hide a monster, quote-unquote monster, creature, whatever,
in Hogwarts
for the purpose of attacking students, I'm just going to put that in there, because we...
like, build your own Chamber of Secrets.
Yes, yes. Like, what creature would you want to guard your Chamber of Secrets from future generations at Hogwarts?
Okay. I just think dragons are so cool. And so if I could, like, get me a dragon and train it to guard my Chamber of Secrets, Audrey's personal Chamber of Secrets, I think I would have to choose a dragon because, well, like, I mean, it's they're definitely not my favorite Fantastic Beast, but I think when we're saying, like, quote, monster, you know, like, something that's, like, really capable of killing, I think it would be so cool if you had, like, an underground, I don't even know if it has to be underground, but this huge, like, Chamber of Secrets that's kind of, like, big enough for the dragon to, like, fly around. Like, I would enchant it, kind of like the tent, and make it massive, and I'm just, like, imagining my dragon, like, completely annihilating everyone that comes near it.
So, if Rowena made a Chamber of Secrets, what do you think she would hide in it?
Oh. She had a diet.
I know what Helga would hide in it.
Food?
Maybe? No, she'd hide the recipes. her patented recipes.
I don't know what Rowena would hide.
I feel like she would, like, hide her daughter so her daughter couldn't get away from her. I feel like she'd be the kind of mother that would, like, lock her daughter in the tower.
Oh my god. No.
Ravenclaws aren't really known for their warmth, Audrey. I hate to break it to you.
I'm a warm Ravenclaw. Yeah, no. I think she would have, like, I think there'd
maybe
just
like
be, like,
old
books. And, yeah, that's literally what it would be, like, the restricted section of the library, but, like, so much more. But then again, I don't know if she would want to hide all that. Like, maybe she would just let certain people in. Like, it'd be, like, only Ravenclaws could access these books, you know? Because if you hide all of them from everyone, like, then no one gets to read the books and all of that dies
with her. Gets the knowledge.
So I think, like, a super dope library. And that's why it would be big enough.
Yeah.
To, like, it would have, like, really high shelves. And then inside, there are dragons that you could ride up to the top to get your books. And outside, there's a just...
Would the dragon breeds that you would use be a Swedish short snout, by any chance?
Well, those would be the inside ones.
Yeah.
Because they're nicer. And yes, they would most certainly be Swedish. Because we love Sweden over here.
We do love Sweden. Yeah, Elskar Sverige. Okay. Pulling out my Swedish.
Also, wait, shout out, like, not shout out. I don't know, if anyone has friends in Sweden, we need to get them to listen to our podcast, because right now, we have listeners in the other Scandinavian countries, or we have downloads at least. Shout out to you guys, Scandinavia, we love you. But Katie and I met in Sweden, and we feel like we need some Swedish listeners, so.
We do.
I don't know, tell your Swedish friends.
Yes, please. Maybe I'll contact my host family, make them download.
Yeah.
Get that.
I don't think my host family would be interested.
I don't think mine would be either. Anyways, back on topic. My monster that I would use to hide all of Helga Hufflepuff's recipes would be a sphinx. Because I think, I mean, a sphinx is kind of Ravenclaw-y
in
general.
Is.
Like, they have to solve the riddle to get in.
But you took this answer before I did.
I did. And also, I chose it from, again, the Goblet of Fire. Because the scene with the Sphinx is one of my favorites, and they can be very vicious, and they're like, they will protect whatever you put them in front of until the person solves the riddle. And I'd make my riddle harder than the spider riddle, because that one was kind of easy. But yeah, I think that they would be a really good, like, protector. Because, like, dragons and basilisks, they, like, I mean, if you're not a Parseltongue, like, they would attack you even if you were a Slytherin, like, a pureblood, you know? So, like, that was specifically only Parseltongues could get in and out, or Parselmouths.
Right.
Right. Whichever one is correct. But, like, a Sphinx is something, yeah, that, like, you could get into and be safe. Like, once you solve the riddle, the Sphinx will be no danger to you.
That's why I would train my
very
dragon.
Good protector.
How to Train Your Dragon.
How to Train Your Dragon.
Really Chamber into that Secret movie, Edition. Really into Game of Thrones, you know, like.
Mother of Dragons.
Winter is coming. Okay. We'll cross.
Winter is ending.
So, go subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean. Can you subscribe on Podbean? You can download.
You can follow. Yeah, you can follow on Podbean.
If you've already listened to this whole episode, I hope you've already subscribed. But be on the lookout for more episodes released every other Tuesday. And leave us a review. Thanks.
And then you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, both as Wizard Studies Podcast. And then if you have any suggestions for episodes, pop quizzes, or do you just want to hit us up in our email is wizardstudiespodcast@gmail.com.
Definitely send us pop quiz questions, because we always have trouble thinking of them.
We struggle, yeah.
All right, as always, thank you so much for listening, and remember, just do your best, we'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.